September 17th, 2010, the Norris Group returns with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate 2010. The Norris Group has assembled an incredible lineup of industry experts to discuss the state of REO from the inside, including regulatory intervention and aftermath, bulk buying myths and facts, and the opportunities emerging for eager real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for the Cure. This event would not be possible without generous help from the following platinum partners: The Business Press, Foreclosure Radar, and Sean O'Toole. The San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan. Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest. Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander. San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry. Claudia Buys Houses. Fry Wiles, the creative agency responsible for iSurvive2010.com. MVT Productions, who always provide our audiovisual needs. And White House Catering, who will provide the three-course meal for this black tie event. Visit iSurvive2010.com for details.
Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Mike Novak Smith. Mike's been a household name in the REO business since the 90s, not just in Riverside or in California, but really a national leader when it comes to REOs. Mike, welcome to our show.
How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing good. Just trying to figure out what's next. When did you get started in REOs?
The first REO I ever closed was in January 1991.
Okay, which was...
RT Resolution Trust Corporation was the first REO client I ever had. And they were taking care of the failed savings and loan assets from the 80s. That's what they were doing.
And how did you decide that that would be a smart business model?
Well, things were winding down in the fourth quarter of 1990. You could feel it. And I read a lot, and I pay attention. And I could see where the market was changing, and I heard about the Resolution Trust Corporation. So when they called and wanted to give us listings that nobody else was interested in because they only paid 5% instead of 6%, I jumped all over it. I figured I could survive with it.
Wow. One of the things that struck me, one of the times that I spoke at your office, was that they were going over the numbers for either the week or the quarter, and there was such a stark difference between the volume of the entire office compared to just you. And so you had 35 transaction closes, and then the second place person had two, and then there were six people tied with one. And you realized, okay, somewhere along the line, you had really made the correct business model decision. So, you know, it's interesting that somebody would pass on 5% and not realize that the volume would be there and continue to be there. Because in 1991, that was just the beginning of quite a run.
Yes, no, that's true. I just, like I said, I read a lot. I try to pay attention. And I just view it as a way to survive. I figured, okay, if I get 2.5% of these deals, I can still make the house payment, the car payment, so we can eat every month.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, and then once I started doing it, I liked it because it was more of a business than always chasing down the next deal. I mean, once you pass the audition, you're good.
I guess there's a lot of people that now they try to do the audition, and what's some of the surprises to them? Okay, let's say they pass the audition and they become an REO agent for the first time. What do you think surprises them?
I think the first surprise is the amount of, there's several. The first is how much work you really have to do. Number two, how much money you have to put out to get properties up and going for, you know, rekeys, trash out, utilities. And third, I sometimes you're treated a little harshly. Not that they're being rude on the other end or being mean. It's just business. They don't have time to sugarcoat it. It's not the same experience as going in with a homeowner and everybody's very friendly. Some of the relationships are that way, but a lot of it's pretty harsh. It's just emails, it's websites, they just operate at a different level. But really, it's the amount of work and the amount of costs that one has to put out, I think, that scares many.
So a lot of people just can't wait to be an REO agent until they are one. And then all of a sudden, uh-oh.
It's pretty frightening, and you have to have some skill. Your skill level's got to be far superior than just doing retail deals. You've got to know what you're doing, because you're going to get eaten up alive if you don't.
You'd say it's a very competitive business.
It is very competitive, and in fact, if you make a mistake or you goof a deal up, there's 100 people that want your place. But also, the smart REO sellers know that there's not many people that can really handle what they need done, cost-wise, emotionally, skill-wise. It's hard. And so it cuts out a lot of the possible players.
The 90s cycle, what was the peak years there? And it would seem like the 90s were much more consistent than the cycle we're currently experiencing.
I would say the peak years was probably about 96 to about 98.
Okay.
For me.
Okay. But you were in it from 91, and you just gradually started gaining the reputation and getting more and more accounts. Is that basically how it works?
That is correct. Yeah, I started in 91. I was already in the business several years just doing retail, which is what REO agents call the owner-occupied deals. And then all the way through January of 04, I had REOs. From 04 to about the middle of 05, I had zero. And I just worked, I had a third-party client that treated it like REO, and I sold a lot of houses for them. But I did go through the one stretch, maybe 15, 18 months with no REOs, but that's been it in almost 20 years.
Really? I guess I would have even had a question here. What do you do in the off-season? Because California was doing awfully well from 2000 to 2007, so I really would have thought there wouldn't have been enough REOs during that cycle. But
well, there was. I closed in, I remember 03, I closed 110 REO sides, but there was a lot less of them. But the clients pick who they use, and I was just, I think, one of the last guys they kept using until they had zero. And then when it started up in 05, in 1 month, I had the first three that Wells Fargo had, and I had in California, they had three REOs. I had all three. So it's kind of like I was one of the last guys to be used and the first one to be called up. So that's kind of what happens.
It does seem like it's very repetitive. You see the same names in the 90s have reemerged. Are the people that you're dealing with, have they remained the same, or are they completely different?
There's a few people that I know from the 90s that are around, but most of them, because they're in corporate America, if they've done well, they've moved up. They're in management positions, things like that. A lot of them do move around. And if you're an REO broker and, you deal with somebody that worked at Countrywide and they change companies to another company and they like you, they'll take you with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helped me a lot. By the same token, if they don't like you, they're going to say, why are you using this guy as soon as they arrive? But overall, it is a contact business. They need to know you. They need to, they have a big problem on the other end. They have a house they have to sell. They have assets they have to move. And the way the pay structure is for asset management people, they have to get the job done. So they're going to use agents that allow that.
What do you think is different between this cycle and the 90s? First of all, let's talk about the inventory. Is the inventory newer?
Well, the inventory, in the 90s, the inventory, I had a lot of houses, let's say in 1994. I remember having 20 four-bedroom, three-bath houses all repaired in Moreno Valley within about 5 miles of each other. They were fairly new homes.
Okay.
Today, we get a lot of new ones. I mean, I get them that are, I've had houses that are not even finished construction, and we've gotten them back as repos, but I would say the mix of the age of the homes is about the same. I don't see much difference in that.
Okay. What about the consistency of the inventory? It seems like the 90s were the foreclosure numbers continually ramped up, and there seemed to be probably more REOs during the cycle. At this time, I mean, you were enormously busy almost out of the gate, and then things just changed.
Well, what I see now, it seems to me like we'll go through a several-week period where we might get a number of REOs. All of a sudden, we think, well, we're getting a lot. Then the following week, we get zero. So I don't know if that's a function of the trustee sales changing their bid prices or, the amount going back to the beneficiary. I don't really know. But it does not seem to be any trend you can actually follow. It's just kind of up and down.
The people that you deal with, asset managers, do they have decision-making power? Do they understand what the policy is likely to be, or are they are they really just the working man, and they don't have any more idea what the next policy will be than anyone else?
Yeah, I don't believe the people that the REO brokers deal with would really know the actual absolute policy direction of their employer. I don't think anybody knows that except the top few people. I don't know. You hear all sorts of rumors, but I never really hear anything concrete.
And I would think that you'd be talking to some people that were pretty high up at this point.
Sometimes I do. They'll call me and they say, what do you think of some policy or something we're going to do? I'm on several broker panels where, you know, they get their top brokers and they have a meeting on the phone, you know, every several months. I do that also. But overall, I think in some ways it's become such a Wild West show. I don't really think anybody really knows. The government rules change constantly. A lot of policies change. It's just, it's also volatile. I don't really think that anybody has their has control of the whole situation.
At the peak of this cycle, how many listings did you have?
The most amount of files was over 900.
900, oh my gosh.
Maybe 600 active in the MLS.
Mm-hmm. And now what volume?
We've probably got about 100 files. And the main issue now is that some of them, they take a long time just because of the evictions. It's much more lengthy from the time they go to trustee sale to get them on the market than they used to be. You know, we spend months getting properties ready, dealing with, you know, occupants. All those laws have changed. It just takes time. So your inventory, a lot of it, if the inventory was really moving through quickly like it should or like it used to, we wouldn't have that many. But they cycle, once we get them listed, they cycle through pretty quick. But it's just getting them to that point where they're ready to list is the difficult part.
So what has changed to delay the house from getting vacant? I know there's rule changes. People, is the occupant pretty aware they're supposed to get cash for keys?
I think it's pretty much known on the street that you're going to get some money to move. I think it's just become urban legend. They know the game.
Okay.
And, they want to, they know how much money are we going to get. I mean, that's just instant. And I think they're pretty wise to it. I have a few clients that still try to get people to move out for $1,000 for, you know, the magic number has become like $2,000 to $4,000. It's just depending on the value of the asset. But generally, they know what they're doing. They're playing. Many are playing a game. Some of them have sincere problems, but many it's just a game.
What typically is the length of time people haven't made a payment when you end up with an REO? Is that something you ever pay attention to?
Yeah, I do my own informal little survey. I've asked a number of tenants, when was the last time you made a payment? It seems to be about 15 to 18 months is a magic number I get when I actually talk to an owner-occupant.
Okay.
It seems like the tenants' rental properties, I get a lot more of those back than I do the owner-occupied properties, which I think it makes sense because many of the owner-occupied homes are in, loss mitigation phases for loan mods, forbearances, things like that. But the non-owner-occupied properties just go through the system much more quickly. But 15, 18 months is what I see.
Now, the people that are occupying the property, is the property being in foreclosure, is that usually a surprise to them?
Yes, I think many... One advice I give to people that are tenants, they ask me, how can I avoid this problem in the future? I always say, make sure you get your rental property when you're a renter. Make sure you get it from a real estate broker that manages rentals. You know, don't go to the laundromat and see some sticky on a wall and try to rent a house or off a Craigslist where they're not real estate brokers. You have some protection dealing with professionals, and that's what I see quite a bit. You know, just, they're concerned that they were taken advantage of, and they don't want it to happen again. And I do see quite a bit of that where people move into a house and 2 months later they find out it's in foreclosure.
One of the things that we had asked of us, which was surprising as we started renting some houses, was they were asking that question of us, you know, do you have a loan? Is it current? And I had never had a tenant ask that question before, but it was obvious that they had just had that experience, where they had been forced to move and weren't told that was going to be imminent. The way that you communicate with the asset managers, how has that changed from the 90s to this cycle?
Well, I do have a few. We still do it the old way I was doing it in the 90s, but most of them use proprietary websites. Offers come in, you put them in electronically or email. the offer to them. That's most of it's done in writing. They don't have too much communication verbally. Fax machines are pretty much out. It's scan the offer and email it, or go on their website and put in the terms of the offer onto their website, and it's sent electronically, which is good because you can manage more properties that way on both sides.
At the level of the asset manager, what powers do they have, and what powers don't they have?
Well, they have leeway. They have a certain, they have a percentage of list price that the system often will take, or they can take. And, if it's pretty much an ordinary offer with normal allowable closing costs, the asset managers have the ability, and their system has the ability to take it. If it's out of the box, something extraordinary, then it has to go up to upper levels.
Do you have, one of the things that I really don't understand is the role of the servicer in all of this. So when you get a listing, first of all, is it usually directly from a lender, or is there a company in the middle that's involved?
Well, there's many that do sell them direct. I mean, they have their own REO department within their organization, and there's many they outsource. They've gotten hit with so many REOs, and I think so much of their labor force is taken up with spending more time on the evictions and the whole foreclosure process, which has gotten much more complicated. They outsource what they can't handle. And the outsourcers oftentimes use the same systems as the direct REO sellers. So it is a little different. For an REO broker, if it's the outsourcer, sometimes you tend to float more money for them. But it's pretty much the same game.
You feel comfortable you get paid back 100% of the time when you're floating this money?
Yeah, generally I would say most of the time, 99% of the time, if you do your billing correctly and you follow their guidelines and you pay attention to it, in other words, you're doing it on a daily basis or at least weekly, you'll be paid back. But yeah, one has to make it a priority, and one has to have staff to do it. You can't just do it all yourself, or you will fail. And that's where many of the reimbursement problems happen. You've really got to pay attention. I mean, REO broker, you wear many hats, and accountant is one of them.
In the beginning of the cycle, I know the lenders really had a very optimistic opinion of what they were probably going to get for a property. And I remembered attending a meeting where there was probably, 1,500 brokers in the audience, and there was a group of lenders in the front. And the brokers were complaining about the broker opinion process, and the lenders pretty blatantly said that at that time, and this was probably 2007, that they were listing the property with the highest broker opinion. And I remember sitting there going, I can't believe somebody just said that, because it would seem that would be a perfect system to fail and have a very lengthy ownership in a down market. So has that changed? Has the lender come around to saying, you know what, we're going to listen to a reasonable BPO?
I think some of them, what happens if they have much discrepancy between the first two BPOs and an appraisal, most all of them get an appraisal and the two BPOs, then what they do is they get a third BPO. And, just to me, a lot of the BPOs, they need to be done by REO brokers. Many of the BPOs today are done by agents that have never sold an REO in their life, never dealt with one, but they are willing to do the BPO for $50. So that BPO, to me, does not have a lot of value. But if they're done by genuine working REO brokers, most of the time they come out pretty similar. And they're just like normal sellers where they want to get the most money they can. Many of them will price it, one level for a month, and then they wait a few weeks or 30 days, and they'll reduce the price just to make sure that they're getting the most they can.
Looks like the emphasis is going to be shifting from REOs to short sales. Is that something that you're getting involved in?
Yeah, I was doing short sales. I did hundreds of them in the 90s, and we closed a couple of them last year, and we've got more going on now. I do them just because some of the REO sellers have asked us to do them. You know, they say, here's the client, here's who your client's going to be, and we want to do the deal, and here's what our parameters are. But, yeah, I will do them. It's just I'm pretty particular about what I deal with. Many of them are just very difficult to deal with, and I can look at the cast of players on the short sale and decide as a business decision whether I want to do it or not. Some of it just takes too much time, and it's going to be more trouble than it's worth. It just depends what I see.
I think that's the one thing that is a little bit confounding to me is the length of time that it takes to do a short sale. I don't really understand why something that seems to be pretty simple takes 6 months.
Yeah, you know, the last one I did, we closed it probably, it took 6 weeks total because it was one I was invited into. It was, they said, here, go list the house with this seller. Deal's approved. We've got all the paperwork. They wanted to do it because I was dealing directly with the many on the loan.
Right.
What happens with many of them, you know, when you've got a first, let's say you have a first and a second, we might have a PMI company involved, a loan investor involved, a servicer involved. Then you've got the second. So you've got all these players, and top off, you know, maybe add in an HOA lien or lawsuit to top it off. And before you know it, it gets very complicated. You've got to get all these people to agree and take a loss. It's not easy to do. It just depends how complicated the deal will be. But, you know, if it's just a first and you can get to the people that are actually going to take the hit, they can take 10 minutes.
Okay. Now, what's interesting is there's no compensation for you until you have a closed escrow.
That is correct.
So somebody getting in the short sale business from scratch might be 6 months away from a check.
That's correct. Any part of the real estate business, you can be 6 months away from the check, as you know. But, you know, it really, as a broker, as an agent, you really one has to really look at the short sale and who the players are, once again, and see, hey, is this something I want to work on? Is it going to be worth the time? And some of them are not. Also, you have to look at the motivation and the reason for the short sale from your client, the seller. Do they deserve the deal? If that answer is yes, number two, are they going to help you in getting the paperwork? You need to participate. If you can't get somebody to help you participate actively in the deal, then your deal's never going to make it. It's not worth doing. It's just I have to look at a few things before I decide I'm interested.
What do you think 2011 looks like as far as your business model?
I think there'll be the REO level increase. I think a lot of the foreclosure modification programs, the state programs, some of the actual client programs, they've run people through, they've done their loan mods, they've either worked or failed, and I believe more properties will become REO.
And you think short sales will be increasing as well?
Yes, I think they'll increase, but I think they'll be difficult to do. And what happens with the short sales, what happened in the 90s was that there was, it became kind of the flavor of the month, somewhat like now, you know, where everybody, all the agents want to do short sales. But what would happen is some of the loan servicers and the investors figured out, hey, we're better just to foreclose and have an REO than waste 8 or 9 months on this. Because then they control the process. They don't have as much control without owning the asset. So I think in some cases, you'll see more properties going to REO quicker because they don't want to mess with a short sale. And there'll be some that want to do short sales. It's just, I think it's just going to be a mix.
I think you probably have a lot more experienced people on the REO side than you do the short sale side.
Correct. They control the broker pool. What they used to do in the 90s, they would say, okay, we're going to do the short sale for you, but we're going to eat over $100,000 of loss here. You're going to use one of these three brokers, and they make them pick one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll happen again. What happens now is if you get a broker, an agent that doesn't have much experience, and they try to get into getting the short sale done, and it takes an extra 6 months because of that inexperience, the loan servicer may say, well, we would have been ahead just to have an REO here.
Yeah. Mike, we're out of time. Mike Novak-Smith has been generous in sharing what he knows about this business. And, Mike, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2010. Adrenaline Athletic, Benton Investment Group, Community Reinvest Workshop, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Entrust California, Everlast Photography, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Keystone CPA, Landwood Title, Las Brisas Escrow, Leyva's Financial Services, Mike Cantu, North San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Investor Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Summit Solutions, Tony Alvarez, the REOMentor.com, WealthPoint, and Weston South Coast Plaza. To find out more about I Survived Real Estate 2010, visit isurvived2010.com.